Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is author and journalist Cal Flynn, and we're talking about her book, Islands of Abandonment, Nature Rebounding in the Post-Human Landscape. Cal, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this very weird book.
Thank you.
I have to ask you, what set you off on this rather strange journey?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question, actually, because I've been writing a lot about nature and the environment for a while. But what I started to get really interested in, I suppose, were these sort of almost like weird nature places or like contested environments. And I wrote this one piece for quite a small magazine over here, which was about man-made landscapes and kind of the aesthetics of them. I went to this area, which is not actually in the final book, but it kind of set me off this way of thinking. And I went to an area called the Slate Islands off the west coast of Scotland, which are former slate quarries, and these tiny islands with really, really deep quarries in them. So they look like donuts, or they're sort of pocked and pitted, and they've been flooded with seawater. And actually, they're kind of weirdly beautiful because they're covered in shoots of broken slate, and you can go swimming in the old quarries, and all the water is very sort of strange turquoise colors. And so I started thinking about the aesthetics of that and why that's interesting, you know, these really almost ruined environments, but they were actually weirdly beautiful. And then I suppose from there I started looking at what plants were coming back, what birds like to hang out there, and I started reading a bit more into it and realized that the science of abandoned environments is actually extremely interesting and is a sort of growing area of science at the moment. This like post-human or this human impact environments are a big sort of growth area at the moment.
It's really interesting because all the places are linked by their fact that they've all been abandoned by humans. And one takeaway I came from the book is, no matter what we do to the environment, if we just get out of the way and sort of leave it alone, totally, nature in some form will come back.
Yeah, I think in some form is the key.
Yeah, it's not going to be the original, cadre of species, and it'll be a different ecology. But the key thing is that humans have to be out of the picture.
Yes, or certainly not trying to control what's going on. I guess one thing that this book really made me appreciate was how often, and especially in conservation and just generally our attitude towards the natural world, is we want it to be sort of achieving goals. So we set ideas for it. So we'd like things to grow back, or we'd like them to be productive, or we'd like them to be biodiverse. And I think what I find really interesting about these places was how rich they were as environments, despite the fact there weren't sort of people going in and fertilizing them or you know, planting new species. And in a strange way, that meant that the ecosystems that sprung up were almost stronger because they were self-sufficient, self-willed. The species that ended up there are the ones that can cope, and often that's difficult to predict which ones will do well.
You make a point early on in the book that there's a difference between abandonment and rewilding. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. So rewilding is a really, you know, laudable aim at the moment, but it's different in as much as that this is, I suppose people have, they buy land to rewild, or often rewilding goes on alongside human activities. So in the UK, we have Isabella Tree, for example. She's been rewilding a farm. It's still, to some extent, a farm. She keeps cattle on it, just a much, much lower intensity. And she is, you know, adding plants here and there, and she retains a certain element of control. And I think people who work in rewilding are keen to say, you know, what we're advocating for is not wholesale abandonment. And from my point of view, you know, I'm not an activist. I'm not sort of arguing for a particular movement. So I'm just studying those pure examples of abandonment, which are not being sort of encouraged to do anything in particular. They're not bringing in, for example, grazers, as rewilders often do, to create structured environments. You know, they're completely gone wild in the purest sense.
I think people in the United States would be surprised to find that there are several locations in your book in the United States, including Paterson, New Jersey, the Arthur Kill, Staten Island, and interestingly enough, sections of Detroit. Talk about that. I mean, the Detroit chapter was to me, one of the stranger chapters.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I suppose, so one point I'm making is that abandonment, when I talk about these islands of abandonment, they can be on different scales. So we might be talking about a small patch of abandoned land, or so in the case of Paterson, New Jersey, I'm looking at a large area of post-industrial land that is now fenced off, that right in the heart of the city. And in Detroit, I suppose I was looking at what does abandonment mean in the context of an urban environment? Because you can talk about abandoned buildings and so on, but there are still a lot of people around. So what is it about abandonment that we react to when we see pictures of, I suppose, areas of Detroit which have a large number of derelict or vacant houses? And why does that impact people? Why do people seem to be bothered by that? Because abandoned buildings particularly tend to have quite a powerful psychological impact on the surrounding community. So it's often linked to very poor health outcomes, for example, or higher levels of depression, I think partly because people react with a sort of visceral feeling towards abandoned buildings. It makes them feel uncomfortable. So I think that's what I was sort of waving towards, which is I have some examples which are true islands. So I went to an island off the north coast of Scotland where
I thought that was I've got to talk to you about that. Okay, is that Swona? Okay. Are you talking about Swona?
I'm talking about Swona, yes.
Okay, let's tell a story of Swona, because Swona, it, to me, was the sort of the eeriest of the places, although you went to some extremely dangerous places like Chernobyl. But Swona is this tiny island that people have lived on for a while with their cows, and then and then they were abandoned. But the cows, the cows remained, and that message that the boatman who dropped you off said, don't sleep outside, otherwise the cows will trample you?
Yeah. What's that? Very ominous. I mean, the entire episode that I spent on that island was so frightening and so weird. And
it was eerie. I mean, that was like, some of the chapters are just scary and frightening and sort of sobering. You end with this Swona chapter, and it was like something out of a film. The people who lived there sort of eking out their living, grazing cattle, and one by one, until the last person was there, they dropped out. Their cottages are still there, which are in various states of decay, and you had to sleep in one. But the cows have, it's more than gone feral. Have they gone wild?
Yes, I mean that's what I'm interested in. Like, where does the boundary start and stop? You know, so certainly you can definitely say they're feral, but at some stage, surely after generations and generations pass, we have to accept that they're becoming something wild as well. And certainly they behave in a wild way. They're not sort of overtly aggressive, but they are very defensive, and they behave when they wander around the island a lot like, I don't know, like stags and deer or even wild horses do. You know, they're sort of pick up on the presence of people, and they're not used to it, and then they get sort of stampy and snorty, and they definitely weren't happy that I was there.
And there's this one cottage you stay in, which you couldn't even get through the door. You had to go in sort of a weird back way, and you're sleeping there. And didn't the guy tell you that they had gone into the cottage like a year or two ago, and they had found a red tent?
That's right, yeah, which he thought... Well, he was telling me quite sort of cheerily, because he thought maybe I would want to sleep inside the tent. And he was like, I'm sorry, where did this tent come from, and who put it there? And he had no answer to that. So I find that extremely unnerving, that there might be, you know, sort of unseen people wandering around the island. The tent had gone by the time I was there.
And the spookiest thing is you're trying to get to sleep, and there's this, like, stomping around above you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Really very loud, as if it's... A full-grown man, it sounded like. I thought I was alone in the house with a complete stranger stamping and running around.
Okay, Cal, did you ever find out what that was? And just, you don't have to give it away, but just say yes or no.
I'm pretty sure. So I went out the next morning, and there was a hole in the roof. So I'm pretty sure it must have been a very large seabird nesting inside the roof. For some reason, they came alive at night time. but it was... unnervingly human.
I was amazed in this book how many really truly dangerous places you end up going for different reasons. Chernobyl is obvious. You went to the zone of alienation, the dead zone. And that was again, you're your prose is very evocative, and you really get a feel for these places. There are people living there, right?
That's right, yes. I mean, in fact, this sort of surprised me about almost all the places, no matter how dangerous it was, people tended to pop up there. But in Chernobyl, they're called the Samosli, and it's people who couldn't really adapt to living outside of their home place. And they've sort of broken back into the zone and often moved back into the same houses. Many of them are farmers, or they live in the smaller villages as opposed to Pripyat town, which was the dormitory town for the nuclear plant. But often they're the farmers, and they were just so sad to leave their land, and they couldn't adapt to living in, you know, a high rise in Kiev. So, yes, I found that their story is sort of very touching, the fact that they decided, you know, that they'd take the danger of the radiation just to be at home.
Is it still contaminated where they are?
Well, for the man that I spoke to, he'd been quite lucky in as much as the levels of contamination are very uneven across the zone just due to luck.
And they seem to know where those zones are, right?
Yeah, so it's mapped, although it does change a little bit. It's kind of settled now. And so he was living in a fairly healthy zone within the zone. But some of the Samosli are living in quite contaminated regions, and they do go out and they will eat the fungi, which is particularly dangerous. And I think there's this sense that, you know, they're elderly almost invariably, and they've gotten this far that they've decided just to completely revert to their old way of living and take the risk as it comes.
Now, you had to wear a dosimeter, right?
Say that again, sorry?
You had to wear a dosimeter? Or?
Yes, that's right. So we carried them around with us. And so they record kind of present time readings, and they also record how much that you absorb over the period that you're within the zone.
Were you at all apprehensive about being in a place like that?
Yes and no. I mean, there's two aspects there why you might not be afraid. One of which is that if you're going in for the length of time that I did, which was about 48 hours, you are probably going to absorb about as much radiation as you might on a transatlantic flight, which I would do without thinking.
Right, right.
And the second thing is that it's so completely intangible that when the alarm is not, you know, wailing on your Geiger counter, your dosimeter, then it's very easy not to believe in the radiation around you. And I can completely see how these mostly settlers, you just get used to not thinking about it because the world around you, apart from the abandonment, looks very normal, and there's plants and animals and so on. So it's this sort of invisible danger that it's very difficult to truly understand and appreciate, if that makes sense.
It was amazing to read that animals like wolves, lynx, deer, elk have all returned to the area, but I have to believe that their genetics are a little bit dinged because of the radiation.
Well, it's a really, really interesting and also very controversial question, actually. I mean, generally, I would say that the attitude is that many of the species that have returned to the zone are doing unexpectedly well, given the enormous amounts of radiation that many of them dealt with in the past. I mean, the radiation is sort of tailing off, apart from in very specific areas. But overall, you'd say, especially with things like wolves and bears and so on that keep moving around, that it doesn't do them any good, but certainly they seem to be breeding and living and surviving. There are some scientists who are a lot more alarmed, actually two American scientists, and they've picked up on a sort of dangerous lack of, I suppose, like leaf litter, insects and so on, and they've picked up on things like albinism in swallows. So there are certainly things that have been noticed within the animal and insect populations within the zone that is worrying, but it certainly doesn't seem to be stopping things living there.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is author and journalist Cal Flynn, and we're talking about her new book. It is a great read, Islands of Abandonment, Nature Rebounding in the Post-Human Landscape. Other kinds of dangerous places that you went into in this book were these zones in between political entities. And I'm thinking specifically in Cyprus, where there's this weird buffer zone. Can you talk about that? And that seemed to me the highest potential for something happening to you was in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started talking a little bit about no man's land and their link to animals and wildlife sort of returning, because this is something that's been noted a number of times in history. And so in Cyprus, I went to the buffer zone between north and south, which is between the sort of Turkish-occupied area in the north and the more Greek Cypriot area in the south. Now, this is a buffer zone that was created by the UN during civil war there, and it's essentially been in a huge stalemate since the 1970s. And so some areas under special permit systems are now being farmed again, but most of it is completely abandoned. Some of that is, there's a very sort of narrow band that runs through their capital city of Nicosia, and that's very sort of weird to look at because it's a very bustling city on either side, and then there's this street just full of palm trees and leaves and grass and all sorts of going right through the center of the city. And it's a very sort of weird thing. You can see sort of the two cultures on either side. And then outside of the city, towards the west of the island, I drove all the way along the edge of the buffer zone, and it gets really quite sort of wild and remote on the west side of the island. And there are a number of small villages which are completely enveloped by the buffer zone. And, you know, from a human social point of view, it's actually a really tragic story because these people have never been able to return to their houses. And from the environmental point of view, it's interesting in as much as many of the species that are sort of suffering on a very densely populated and highly developed island are finding a kind of sanctuary within this very policed region. So there are types of rare sheep there. There's an endemic mouse. There's very, very rare plants which are popping up in this region. And, you know, they're essentially being watched over by people with machine guns stopping people going in there. And it's a very similar case in the Korean DMZ, which is even harder to gain access to because they've got sort of, you can't even get right close to it without being in the military. There's sort of talk of there being sort of Amur leopards and cranes, which are, you know, deeply beloved in the Korean Peninsula, all sorts of species, again, finding this kind of safe haven between the mines and the machine guns and the watchtowers. So it's quite a weird and jarring state of affairs.
Are there landmines in the Cyprus location, or is it just watched over by people with guns?
Yes, there certainly have been landmines. There have been efforts to de-landmine areas, but I believe there are still some areas left. So in other landmine areas actually of interest, in bits of Kurdistan, a type of leopard has been doing really well in a landmine area because, of course, people don't go in. And the leopards, because they spread their weight out over 4 feet instead of two and are slightly lighter than humans, don't set them off. So there are a couple of other similar cases.
I just want to mention, there are many places that you go to in this book, each of them very different from the other, and each has their own story. Arthur Kill in Staten Island is an area where there's been the Diamond Alkali Works, I think it was. There's tremendous amounts of poisonous material that are in the water in the land, and you were told to not even get a drop of the water in your mouth?
That's right. You know, so they've got posters up all around the edge of New York Bay and the Arthur Kill saying, you know, do not eat any of the fish here. And people do fish there partly for fun, but also some people fish there to eat what they catch. And or the most incredible fact, which is if you eat one of their blue clawed crabs, one of those crabs can contain enough dioxin to give a person cancer. So it's an incredibly toxic brew of the pollution that's ended up in that estuary there, partly PCBs, partly dioxins, all of which have like very horrible effects, not only on humans, but on other species as well. And so the species that remain there are the ones that, for one reason or another, have the ability to either to live with these toxins in their system or to somehow not absorb them. So it's really incredible that anything can survive there at all.
There's a fish, the Atlantic killifish, also known as the mummachog, which doesn't seem to be bothered by these at all, by the poisons.
That's right. So this is a really interesting case. So normally you might consider them to be indicator species in as much as they are very easily impacted by toxins. But there are specific communities of these fish, not only in Newark Bay, but also I think in the Victoria River in Virginia and a number of other places where they found PCB or dioxin tolerant fish. And they are basically the fish have through natural selection selected for the fish that are able to survive. And so you get these whole populations of fish that are able to survive, whereas they're sort of cousins or, I suppose, siblings in the normal Atlantic coast would be immediately killed. And it's not so much that they are doing so brilliantly, but the fact that they can survive at all there is really incredible and shows, you know, the power of evolution to overcome these sort of horrible obstacles we keep throwing in our way.
The first place you visit or talk about in the book is a fascinating place. And I had to look up more pictures of it because I wanted to see what it looked like. And that was the Five Sisters in Lothian, Scotland. What are these? This looks like it could be turned into a tourist attraction or something like that. I mean, they're huge.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, these are landscape size. I mean, like hill, even small mountain sized shale heaps or dumps of like gravel-like bits of stone. These date from the 19th century. They're a sort of souvenir left of an oil refining industry that we had here in Scotland. And essentially they superheated the bits of rock, oil shale rock, and then it would sort of crumble into this tiny bits of gravel and then they would pile them up. Now, for decades, they were actually really hated locally, partly because they would occasionally burst into flame or people could get burns from them. But over time, they've settled and in many cases they've been sort of overtaken by new species. It's very similar from a biological point of view as to new volcanic islands. So they're completely bare, sterile from an ecological perspective to begin with. And then over time, seeds sort of rain down, they blow in, or birds might fly over and drop seeds on them in their droppings. And, you know, since the last shale mine closed in the 1960s, so we're talking sort of 50-plus years for each of these shale heaps, or bings, as we call them. And over that time, many of them have sort of developed small woods on them, or they've got trees and grasses. Often, you know, teenagers run a bit wild on them or hide out on them, like there's pools of water. And they're just a really weird landscape. And in a way, I've been sort of driving past them all my life without really thinking too much about them. And then suddenly you're like, this is a strange thing. I wonder, you know, I'll find out a bit more about them. And then the more you learn, the more fascinating it gets.
I mean, people are listening. These are large. These aren't just like a heap. These are like hills.
Yes.
These are like...
Yes, yes.
Now,
so
you actually tried to walk on them, and it sounded like walking on them was a problem. You can't just walk normally on them.
No, you slide down because they're still, you know, it's loose gravel. It's like walking through snow. And so they're so big that they would swallow up, you know, inside one of them there's a big country house because the heat just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it swallowed up this entire country house.
There's no plans for, I mean, there's nothing they can do with them, right? They can't, where could you put, you just have to move the heap to someplace else. And it's too huge.
Some of them have been depleted because they were using them as a type of construction material, like an infill. And then they realized that actually many of them are very ecologically valued. So they're now protected because some of them are sort of amazing landscape size souvenirs that people have now begun to like because they're almost sculptural. And in other cases, you know, they're actually ecologically very important. So they become protected, but for a while they were sort of digging them up and using them to make bricks and so on.
Such an odd series of places that you visit in this book, and it's really fascinating. At the end, you talk about climate change, obviously, what's going on right now, and the big UN report is coming out today. As you describe it, a long, uncomfortable descent into a death phase that to us will feel unending. That's cheery, Cal. but what did this tell you about what's going to happen through climate change, which is we're already in the middle of, or it seems like we're in the beginning of the middle phase?
Yeah, so I suppose there's two aspects here, one of which is it gave me some faith in as much as I knew that some species will manage to adapt. We've adapted, you know, we've seen nature adapt to many awful things and survive and come through. And in a sense, that gives me some sense of optimism. And then there's the other side, which is but what about all the things it can't? And, you know, there are only a number of species that can adapt so quickly. You know, when I talked about the mummy togs being able to evolve to live in a toxic harbour, there are so many other species that can't. And so I think it's that sense of optimism, but it has to be tinged with this sort of anxiety as well, you know, that we shouldn't be carried away by all these wonderful cases of nature overcoming when we're day by day making things worse and worse and more impossible for them. So I think, I don't know. I think I'm like anyone, in as much as some days I feel like maybe we'll be fine, and other days you just get filled with this terrible despair. But we have to push on, and I think we have to find hope somewhere. So I think that's
I don't know if humans will be fine. Some aspect of nature will survive. It just won't be the rich diversity that we have now. I mean, is that more
right?
But I'm not sure how we're going to do. I mean, we can't even manage to encourage people to put on masks. So I'm in a very dark set of mind about how we're going to adapt to climate change.
I don't know. I think things are going to get pretty real, pretty fast, and we'll have to pull together. That's what we'll have to, just cross our fingers that we can act fast when we can.
Just one more last question before we go. What was the most toxic environment where the least amount of life had returned? Was it the Zone Rouge in Verdun, France?
Yes, I think that's right. So this is an area of...
Don't give it away. I just wanted to know that answer. Because that's the feeling I got from the book, and people have to read the book to understand what that is. But that's left over from World War I.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
And really, there was a whole, it's like a chemical scar, let's call it, in the middle of the woods.
And it's still there.
It's still there, and right in the middle of it is completely bare of any species whatsoever. So, yes, I think that might be the one that's still very, very much felt like it was not quite healed at all.
My guest tonight has been author and journalist Cal Flynn, and we've been talking about her book, which I recommend highly, Islands of Abandonment, Nature Rebounding in the Post-Human Landscape. Cal, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You listen to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.